This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
Hi, I'm Mike Bush.
I'm Paul New.
And I'm Colleen Sterling. Welcome to Ask the AMPs from AOPA.
On Ask the AMPs, we take your toughest maintenance questions and we try to solve them. We don't always solve them, but we try to solve them. So if you have a question, especially if it's a tough question, reach out to us at podcasts@aopa.org.
And if you like the show, make sure to follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode, even if we sound like frogs.
We'll have to talk about that, Paul. And if you'd like to get on our email list for our monthly newsletter and some interesting maintenance stories, I'm actually writing up a couple of them right now to send out. The easiest way to do that, if you're in North America, is to pull out your mobile phone and text the word SAVVY, S-A-V-V-Y, to 33777, and a little text bot will ask you for your email address and put you on the list. Again, text the word SAVVY, S-A-V-V-Y, to 33777 to put yourself on our list.
Sorry about the frog thing.
Would you explain yourself?
Yeah, ribbit. Well, ribbit.
I have some sort of virus. It's not COVID like it was last year.
The frog virus, deadly.
The frog virus, I think that's the thing. So I don't feel nearly as bad as I sound, but I think I'm like day 12 of a 10-day something.
Yeah, oh, my.
It's just hanging on. I'll survive.
You took a week off of work to try to recover from this?
I did miss, probably missed about 3 or 4 days, yeah.
That's pretty bad.
And on one of those days, you very graciously gave it to Helen, right?
Yeah. Well, I have this theory, you know. We had a family gathering, and I think Helen's symptoms presented a couple of days later than mine, but a couple of the grandkids got sick, and one of the children got sick. Mm. So I don't know that I am the perpetrator. I'm going to claim that anyway. Try not to be. So,
not that I know a lot about kids, but I've heard kids are germ magnets.
They're just walking petri dishes. Yeah, yeah, they're horrible in that way. But I'm going to try real hard to keep the mute button close by for when the coughing that cannot be stopped. I'll hit that and try to save the editors a lot of work.
Yeah.
So if we see your mouth moving but no sound, we'll know what's going on.
You can tell me, Paul, you need to unmute. And it's been a particular problem with the ADs that have come out because I've gotten, like with the 210, I've gotten a huge number of phone calls.
Oh, I'll bet.
And I had a couple of days where I felt like coming to work, but I couldn't talk. And so it's been very frustrating.
Yeah, I'll bet your phone's been ringing off the hook. You're probably the place in the country for the Cessna, the carry-through SPAR AD.
Yeah, probably. And the thing is, we already have a packed schedule, like every other shop in the country. And so I'm thinking about the AD on the Continental engines as well.
Right.
How in the world we're gonna fit these in? We've turned away, Blake and I were talking about it this morning. We've probably turned away 15 210 SPAR inspections just because we're packed with existing 210 customers that will have to have it. And, you know, we want to accommodate, but man, I don't know how it's going to happen.
This is a huge problem because we're in the middle of a gigantic mechanic shortage in general aviation. I wrote an article back in 2020 titled "The Looming Mechanic Shortage."
Yeah, an IAOPA pilot
is not looming anymore.
It's right there.
And an awful lot of shops are booked up a year in advance. They tell their annual inspection customers to schedule their next annual as they're picking up their airplane from the last one because the schedule is so packed. And then something like this Continental AD or this Cardinal and 210 AD comes along, and there's just no capacity in the system to deal with it. And aircraft owners are unfortunately going to wind up on the beach for a while because there's just nobody to do these things that are being mandated.
Well, in the 210 one, you got to be careful. There's a lot of people that can do engine work. Most shops, you know, can pull cylinders. But like the 210 and the Cardinal, once you take it to the shop for the inspection, if anything is found, that is probably going to be the shop that's going to replace the spar. And so you need to really consider, are they capable?
Are you saying no ferry permits will be permitted?
They have stated that. I think there will be some allowance depending on what's found.
When you say they've stated that, are you saying the AD says no?
In the AD, yeah. It's grounded until the repair is made and there's no further flight. I think some airplanes will be able to get ferry permits, but the majority, if they're actually, if they find a problem,
yeah,
you're not going to get it. And I'm thinking mostly of the Cardinals. The 79 and newer 210s all came from the factory with corrosion inhibiting. They're all primed, and they're probably in good shape. I think what we're going to find on those is damage from upholstery screws, which is what failed the two that I know about that were replaced. One was replaced at my shop.
So it creates a hole and it goes through the corrosion proofing and then it becomes corroded in the hole.
No, it doesn't. Or it's just a hole.
It's just the hole, just, and that's enough to trigger.
That's all you got to have. If something is deeper than, depending on where it is, 10 to 30 thousandths of an inch, and a screw can make a hole easily. We had one that had four holes that were 1/8 inch in diameter and 1/8 inch deep.
Oh, that was an earnest mechanic with a big screwdriver.
But I'm telling you, it held that headliner plastic just beautifully.
The thing wasn't going anywhere.
It wasn't going anywhere.
This thing wore a dent. You call it a hole, but it's like an indent.
Well, these were actually a drilled hole.
Oh, wow.
I've seen that with wing spars where some well-meaning mechanic will.
Yeah. Well, then others will put the PK screws or sheet metal screws in through to hold it. And those little sharp ends just sit there and they just vibrate and nobody pays any attention. And 2 years or 3 years later or whatever, there's these nice little hogged out holes and they've gotten too deep and they're stuck. It's not really corrosion. So, but the Cardinals, I think, are going to be, there's a lot of Cardinals that are corroded. And the last scare, the initial 210 spar AD, I think got a lot of people's attention and got the Cardinal people looking. I know CFO did a great job of encouraging people to look.
Get an inspection, yeah.
Get an inspection done. Now it's an AD, so I think there's going to be some Cardinal ones found. Fortunately, they're a lot easier to change than a 210.
But the spar, if you have to replace the spar.
Yeah, if you have to replace it. But there aren't any spars to replace it with.
And you don't want Joe Mechanic working off the back of his pickup truck to be changing your spar carry-through structure.
It's a job.
Wow.
It's a job for a structural repair facility to do.
I can't imagine. Look at that thing when I take the headliner down and it's massive and all the skin is, you know, over it. It's all enclosed. You'd have to peel the skin back on the top and there's big rivets and there's big bolts driven through to hold the wings on, and the wings have to come off, right?
The wings come off first. The nice thing is you don't have to jig anything because the carry through is bolted to the frame. And once you bolt it, the new one to the frame, it's lined up. There's no alignment to do. So you don't need to build any kind of jig or special fixtures. But anyway, so that's special with that one. But the engine AD.
Now we're switching gears now. This is the TCM counterweights.
Yeah, this is the TCM thing. And as Mike was saying, I don't know how. We got a call from Cirrus, as I'm sure a lot of shops did, And the question was, this is happening. This
how
is
many when, can you do?
How many can you do? When can you start? And I'm sure they called a lot of shops. And they were looking for shops that could do the Cirrus-owned airplanes as well, because Cirrus, as a lot of people know, grounded their fleet, not the airplanes that they've sold, but the ones that Cirrus still owned and had control of, and which I thought was a pretty bold move. It set quite a statement, seems to me, how important they thought it was. It was big.
It always goes back to, I would much rather have a tried and true engine or airplane part or whatever. I don't want to be an early adopter.
Yeah. Oh, this is a new classic infant mortality failure because,
yeah.
Unfortunately, neither Continental nor really the FAA has been as forthcoming as I would like to have seen in terms of telling us exactly what was found to trigger this AD. And, you know, so that leaves us kind of speculating about it because nobody's really talking. And I can kind of understand why Continental isn't talking, because their legal department probably doesn't want to provide any information for plaintiff lawyers to use. But I've always thought that if the FAA is going to mandate something, there ought to be a requirement of transparency for them to explain exactly what persuaded them that this is an unsafe condition and that this is the appropriate applicability. I mean, my sense about this Continental AD from circumstantial evidence, and I can't prove it because nobody's talking, is that we know that there were three counterweight releases due to this problem, two on the ground and one in the air. And we're pretty sure that they all happened in Cirruses that were just coming out of the factory. So they probably all happened at extremely low engine time, you know, like 10 hours or less.
Yeah, or initial startup.
And Continental came out with a service bulletin that said, you know, if you've got over 200 hours time in service, don't worry about this. Basically, what they were saying is, if it was going to come apart, it was going to come apart a lot quicker than 200 hours. And then the FAA said, well, Continental has not provided us enough evidence to convince us that there's no risk for engines over 200 hours. So we're going to include all of these engines, every single crankshaft assembly that was assembled in Mobile from, I think, what was it, June 2021 forward. But I would love to know more about those three cases and exactly when they happened, because my sense is they probably happened at super low time, and that if they wanted to, and they were, and they, you know, the government tends to be super risk averse. I mean, Continental is going to be pretty risk averse because they don't want to get sued, but the government's even more risk averse. But my sense is that they probably could have confined this AD to a much smaller group of engines, ones that had no more than say 50 hours time in service. But nobody was willing to take that risk, and nobody's really talking about what they found and when they found it.
And so the fact that they flooded the market or the support market with all these engines that are going to need inspection is going to have two implications. One is that there's going to be a lot of downtime because people won't be able to get into a shop. And the other is there's a lot of aircraft that are going to have unnecessary maintenance done to them by just pulling the cylinders to do this inspection, which potentially could cascade to further issues if they're not retorqued correctly and put back on correctly.
Yeah.
So it's bad for everybody.
It would, from that standpoint, Colleen, from the collateral damage standpoint, and that's another problem that I have with the AD system, that the FAA is required to go through fairly extensive analysis before they make a determination that an unsafe condition exists that warrants an AD. They are not required to do any analysis of what risk the remedy creates. And there have been a number of ADs. I'm not saying this one is one of those that where the cure is worse than the disease. But it does seem to me that the procedure for ADs ought to be changed so that the issue of how much risk is entailed in doing this thing that you have to take. The Wingspire AD is a pretty good example. How much risk is involved in a Wingspire carry through structure being replaced by a shop who's never done one before?
Yeah.
Is there risk?
The risk of a problem with the installation of the spar carry through is fairly minimal. I mean, it's bolted in place. You got a lot of rivets.
Rivet stuff.
Yeah. Even if they do a sloppy job on the rivets, they're going to hold together pretty good. I don't worry about that. I worry about the flight controls because they take the wings off.
Oh, yeah. Right. And we rig everything.
You've interrupted electrical, which is no big deal. Fuel delivery can be a big deal. And flight controls. Flaps, not too worried about flaps, but ailerons are a big thing.
And the rigging may never be the same again.
The rigging, well, it may not have been right to start with, but I worry more about that, all the peripheral stuff, because most of the time things get bolted on okay, but man, all the other little things. And you talked about, in the spar thing, there was a lot of known evidence that, and even the FAA pointed out that here was this spar failure in Australia. That's what got it all started quite a few years ago. And then they had a lot of data after inspecting a lot of spars. And when they came out with this new AD, they even referenced some of that and said, oh, here's why we're doing it. Which to me, whether you agree with it or not, at least they kind of showed the track that they were on. But I'm with Mike on this, on the engine deal. And it's not that we shouldn't be doing the AD. I'm not disagreeing with that at all. But when people are asked to do something that's not only expensive, but potentially dangerous, you want everyone to have this feeling that it's they buy it. Into the urgency.
Right.
That this is worth the risk. And I think that would be, I don't think the FAA is, I don't mean this in a mean or harsh way. I don't think they have the capability to do a risk analysis of the potential problems that the fix is going to cause.
I think they have the capability. I just don't think they have the mandate to do that.
Well, yeah, they obviously, yeah.
Okay, our first question is from Michael, whose turbo normalizing system isn't being very normal. Go ahead, Michael.
Thank you. I love the show and love the chemistry. I'm also very glad I don't have a Cessna 210 anymore, or my not part of the 2000 affected by the AD. But I do have a turbo normalized 1979 Bonanza. It's a Western Skyways system as opposed to the more popular Tornado Alley. Love the system, except I have a nagging problem where if I go to full throttle on takeoff, it'll overboost. And so I have to go to partial throttle, 29.6 inches of manifold pressure, and I get a little lower than desired fuel flow, 28 to 30 gallons an hour, as opposed to 34, 33 gallons an hour. The controller's been overhauled, the wastegate went out to main turbo, who also did the controller overhaul. They inspected the actuator. They said it looked good, put it back on, readjusted the system, same problem. And so the question is, now what?
Is this something that changed suddenly, or this came on over a period of time, or it's always been this way?
Always been this way, ever since I bought an airplane in 2020.
Okay. Well, I have a couple of comments. It's a very, very bad idea for you to try to obsessively limit your manifold pressure to 29.6 with the throttle. Just let it do what it wants to do. Continental basically says that boosting up to 3 inches over red line is a non-event. What is a big event is not having enough fuel flow. We can kind of speculate as to why you're having this variation in manifold pressure from one flight to another. But the fuel flow is determined by the upper deck pressure. Okay, you've got a fuel pump that has an aneroid on it that is referenced to upper deck pressure, and it modulates the fuel flow according to upper deck pressure. So if you're getting less than the 34 gallons, it's because the upper deck pressure isn't as high as it should be. There's not much that can go wrong with that fuel pump. It can be misadjusted, but it's not going to vary from one flight to another. But I would encourage you not to try to limit your manifold pressure to 29.6 the way you seem to have been doing. You seem to think that's really important. It's not. What's important is the fuel flow. Now, look, if your manifold pressure went to 38 inches, yeah, I would say, okay, yeah, probably ought to throttle back and land and figure out what's wrong. But if it goes to, you know, 30 or 31 or 32 inches, it's just don't worry about it. Just let it happen. But
it, by that pulling actually, back the... Is that actually a red line on this airplane? Because on the Tornado Alley and the Cirrus, the red line is at 32. And when you know, the early takeoff for the first flight of the day, it's common that manifold pressure runs to 32. And then after you've flown for 30 seconds to a minute and everything settles in, oil temperature settles, it comes down to right around 30 and everything's where you want it. I'm just not familiar with the Western Skyways system.
Go ahead.
Red line at 29.6. They do talk about overboost on the first flight of the day, but my manifold pressure as the system warms up doesn't come down, it goes up.
Yeah.
That's different.
Yeah, what he said. Yeah.
But how high does it go up? You're not seeing major excursions above red line, right? You're just seeing a couple inches or so.
Correct.
So just let it happen. Just let it happen. By throttling back, you're reducing fuel flow pretty dramatically, and that's got to be bad for the engine. Much worse for the engine than a couple inches of overboost, which is really, you know, consider that red line like a dotted red line. But you know, the other thing that's a little weird about the system, because you sent us a diagram of the fact that they're using a slope controller and then kind of crippling its function normally this slope controller, that top port that's getting the upper deck air reference, that's normally supposed to get manifold pressure. And then the bottom port, which they sort of have jumpered to the top chamber, that's supposed to be referenced to upper deck pressure. And what's inside that controller is a sealed aneroid, which gives an absolute pressure reference. But the aneroid, instead of being fixed to the housing like it would be in an absolute pressure controller, sits on a diaphragm that moves based on the differential pressure between the top chamber and the bottom chamber. And the idea is that at reduced throttle settings, where there's a significant difference between upper deck pressure and manifold pressure, the diaphragm moves and it reduces the upper deck pressure so the turbocharger isn't working so hard. So it's kind of like a VAPC, a variable absolute pressure controller, except instead of a mechanical linkage to the throttle, it kind of has a pneumatic linkage to the throttle. That's the idea. So they've taken this slope controller and they've hobbled it by connecting the top and bottom chambers together so that the diaphragm basically is immobilized. The slope controller thinks you're at full throttle all the time, even if you're not. So I am not sure why they did that. If they wanted an absolute pressure controller, why they didn't just put a standard absolute pressure controller in.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure whether using a slope controller in this non-standard fashion has any kind of weird effects that could account for some of the things that you're doing, but they're clearly taking a slope controller and trying to coerce it into being an absolute pressure controller for reasons that I have no idea. It would be super interesting to replumb that the way God intended it to be plumbed and see what happens, you know.
Stand back.
Science project.
Minor alteration, right, Paul?
I'm sure. Just a log entry. It's all you need.
I did ask Western Skyways about the slope controller and why they chose it. And the answer I got was before our time.
Well,
the answer was probably they had a lot of them in inventory.
Sitting
at one
around.
Time.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do with these all up? These?
Yeah, we can get rid of these. Like all the straight slotted screws that the Brits still use on their airplanes. It's like we have a bazillion of them left over from World War II. Let's just keep using these.
But I mean, I think the main comment is don't be so obsessive about trying to limit manifold pressure to redline. Be more concerned about fuel flow, because a few inches of additional manifold pressure isn't gonna hurt anything.
Well, great question, and lots of good data to describe it too, which really helped us, Michael. So thank you for being so thorough.
Again, love the show.
Thank you. Take care.
See you, Mike.
Hey, David, I got a riddle for you. How can you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your airplane?
I think upgrading the pilot would be the first clue for that one.
The guy between the headsets, huh? Yeah.
That's right.
All right. That's not what I'm talking about, but I'll give you a clue. It has ADS-B traffic and weather, Sirius XM weather and entertainment, no wires, and it works with 4Flight and Garmin Pilot.
Oh, Ian, I know what that is. It's the Garmin GDL52 Sirius XM portable weather receiver.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, and now, believe it or not, the Garmin GDL52 comes with a 3-month trial of Sirius XM aviation weather and a very special limited time $400 rebate. Learn more about all that this receiver can do and the limited time $400 rebate by visiting sporties.com/GDL52.
So our next question is from Paul, which is always nice. Someone whose name I can remember throughout the entire call. So
the crux of my question comes back to, I fly a 1965 Piper Cherokee with the Lycoming, fantastic little airplane. So got about 1800 hours on the engine. I recently got very close to having to remove a cylinder, ultimately did not have to, which was good.
Awesome.
But it got me thinking that the instrumentation on the engine just is not adequate. It still has mostly stock.
Yay.
So my question for you guys is, as I go out and start looking at and shopping for an engine monitor, what should I be looking for? What are the features I need? What are some of the gotchas that I need to be aware of? For example, gasket probes versus screw-in probes for CHTs that's been talked about here and placement. So I was hoping to get into some of the details for everybody about your recommendations on engine monitors.
Well, I think all the engine monitors offer both gasket and bayonet style probes, or whatever we want to call those things that screw into the well. And hopefully you'll always use the kind that screw into the well, because spark plug gasket probes have issues. One of the things that I think is the most is very, very important when you're selecting an engine monitor is whether it has user programmable alarm settings or whether they're hardwired to the manufacturer's red line. A lot of the engine monitors that are the fancier ones that are primary instrument replacement, where you take a bunch of steam gauges out and you put this thing in, were certified to be hardwired to manufacturers' red lines. which makes the alarms essentially useless. I don't want to know when my CHT reaches 500. You know, I want to know when it reaches 420 or something like that. So that's one of the things I would definitely look for is user programmable alarm levels. And when you install the engine monitor, make sure that you hook the alarm output to something that you can't miss, like a big red light sitting right in the center of your scan.
Most of them will have like a master alarm. So you have a light and you don't know what the alarm is. You just know there's an alarm.
Right. Right. So but it makes you look over at the instrument.
Makes you look at the instrument. Yeah.
Cause normally these instruments are installed on the right side of the panel that are not really in directly in your scan. Cause you're looking at the flight instruments primarily. And so when the engine monitor senses that something is out of limits, it needs a way to tell you that you can't ignore. And in a perfect world, you'd have both a visible and an oral alarm, but at least a visible alarm that's a light that's positioned where you can't miss it, right in front of you, in the middle of your scan someplace.
And if you can mount it closer to you, that's a really good option.
Like in the center console would be great. Console, under your radios.
Yeah, something closer. If you get the non-primary, like Mike was talking about, you can pretty much do anything you want to with it. It's really nice. Get all the same data. They don't weigh all that much. I don't know that there's any manufacturer of these that's bad.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, there's all sorts of different features, different shapes. You can get the square one, different prices, round. And
right. Real estate has something to do with it, too.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Your panel, because like the JPI 730 and 830, which I like a lot, they're rectangular and they take like a hole and a half.
Yeah. But you can get the Insight, you know, will fit right in a standard 3 1/8 inch hole.
Yeah. Isn't a Garmin 275 is the
GI 275 and the CGR30P, the Electronics International, is a really, really, really nice instrument.
So real estate is really important. Having just put two engine monitors in two aircraft, I had to consider where it would fit. Was it in my, could I get it close enough where I could see it? Another thing that I think is that, I don't know about you, but my eyesight's not as good as it used to be. So the 275, I don't know what the display looks like, but I think I might want a bigger display. So being able to see it and liking how the things are presented, I just put a G3X 17-inch, which can go horizontal or vertical, and I'm just using it for engine monitor, not for everything else that it can do, trying to keep the price down. And that's a nice big display that fit in my panel really well, and I felt like it was maybe a little bit farther away than I wanted, but it was big enough that I should be able to see things clearly and get the information that
you
I want.
You say it's 17 inches?
It's
7 inch, isn't it? GDU
7. I was going to say 17 inches, you ought to get Netflix on it.
Yeah, maybe it is the 7 inch. It's fairly small and rectangular. I got the wrong number.
I assume she meant 7. I just got to let it go.
Yeah, okay.
Let me get my ruler out.
I kept thinking about it. Sorry. What other features are there available on it?
The other thing you want to think of, if you're going to go all in right off the bat, it's great. But if you're going to go in and say, I just want EGT, CHT, and fuel flow as a starter and then add other features later, be sure that's an option. And I may be wrong, so all you guys that are Insight fans, I could be wrong. If you get the G2, it is not easily upgradable to a G3 or a G4. You can't always add all those options. I may be wrong on that, but I think I'm correct.
Yeah, fuel flow is very important.
Mm-hmm. Very helpful
and
for troubleshooting.
Also, after reporting on a few forced landings due to loss of oil pressure, I would think an oil pressure sensor where you can get an alarm if oil pressure gets below the bottom of the green. We've just seen a bunch of airplanes come out of the sky, typically because like a mechanic forgot to tighten a B-nut. That seems to be like a big one, especially on Lycomings with remote-mounted coolers where there's too many B-nuts.
Mm-hmm. The more data you can get, the better.
But they all have a lot of data.
They all have a lot.
We were just looking at one where Mike was astonished. What are these things? I don't even know what it was recording.
That thing. Was that a Dynon that we were looking at?
No, it was a G3X.
It was a G3X.
Oh, it was a G3X. Yeah. Holy mackerel.
Information overload.
It was.
As an engineer, but I never believe that you can have too much data.
There you go.
Yeah, but I mean,
you're an engineer. I would have totally changed my tone had I known
when
that
you
from
configure
the
engine monitor and decide what sensors to put on it. Think about what things you would like to be alarmed if they go out of range. And, you know, so like oil pressure is one of those things. You'd really like to get knocked upside the head if the oil pressure drops below the bottom of the grain.
In that same vein, knowing that the alternator is still producing current would be helpful.
Well, so I have a little different. What kind of engineer are you? Let's got to establish this.
Mechanical.
I would. The current output to me is not particularly important, and I'm an old school avionics guy. From way back when.
No, the bus voltage is what's important.
The voltage is what you want to know.
That tells you whether you're on battery power or alternator power.
Yeah. If it's putting out 14 volts, it's doing its job. You don't care how much current it's putting
out.
Right.
And a lot of airplanes do have a low volt light or something like that. But
that's usually too late. But
your radio starts sounding weird by then.
Yeah. Knowing what the current is, and that's, you know, your airplane has an amp meter. And all the Cessna single engines all have an amp meter. I don't know why they chose an amp meter. Back in the day, to me, a voltmeter was the simplest thing. But anyway, the voltmeter, if you had to choose between the two, and almost all of them, even the simplest, will give you voltage because it's monitored. It has to have voltage to operate, and it's a real simple circuit to have a voltmeter display.
Yeah, all of the engine monitors will monitor bus voltage because that doesn't require a sensor. That's the thing is powered by the bus and it's going to measure the bus voltage.
You don't have to have a shunt located somewhere in the airplane.
What about touching on sensors? Are there different types of sensors? I mean, is there, we talked about the different types of CHT probes, but what about fuel flow sensors? Are there different styles of those?
All fuel flow sensors are made by a company named FlowScan, and they're all the same. They have a monopoly.
And the transducers are pretty much the same. You're not going to have a lot of choice. If you buy Garmin, you can pretty much use anybody's sensor and wire it up to your Garmin. But if you get EI or JPI, they will come with sensors, transducers, all that stuff. Don't over torque anything. Just, I might know a guy.
But you know the choice of engine monitor is a very personal thing. You know, like for example, the Insight instruments have a very different looking display than the others, and some people love it, some people hate it. I'm not particularly fond of it, but some people just think it's the cat's meow. So, boy, that's an old phrase.
Yeah.
It must find be dating
a,
me.
Find a wonderful place to put it in your panel, though, where it's up where you can see it, part of your scan. That's really helpful.
And don't forget to download your data often.
Oh, yes.
It's download. Not just a real-time monitor. Yeah. It's a recording device.
Yeah.
It's very powerful for troubleshooting.
You don't have to download after each flight, but download all of your flights.
Yeah.
That history is really important.
Once a month would be really good habit to get into.
When you go out on a Saturday to, pet and groom the airplane, it's a good time.
And then some of the engine monitors record their data on an SD card. And if you don't have an SD card plugged in, then they don't record. So that would be unfortunate too. So
Garmin has
seen a lot of that.
Yeah, Garmin has no onboard memory. And I think the Insight also requires a card.
I'm pretty sure you're right. So. Yeah, the G series is an SD card,
but the JPI has internal memory,
and they won't complain if you don't plug one in. They'll just happily not record the data.
And you want to set the record rate to 1 per second.
Fast.
Yeah, you want, and it, if you have a JPI, you can make it record. Is that JPI or EI? You can make them record even faster, but it eats up the memory huge. So once a second is pretty good. Cool. Well, now we made it clear as mud. And have you made up your mind yet?
Well, that depends. You'll have to let me know who gets in touch about a sponsorship.
Now you got to do some shopping.
Okay. Well, yeah.
Sponsors aren't always the best. They're just the ones with the money.
Paul, now sally forth and pick an engine monitor.
Yeah. And report back. We want to hear what you found.
Will do. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right.
We appreciate the call, Paul.
Oh, and one more thing.
Uh-oh.
I don't know what your timetable is on this, but they often offer big discounts on these things at, like, Sun and Fun and Oshkosh. So you might want to time it to take advantage of that.
That's a good point.
Good thinking. Yep.
Yep. I did that. A couple $100. Can't go wrong.
Nope, definitely not.
Cool. Well, thanks for the question. We love talking about engine monitors. It's something we know. Yeah.
Thanks for letting us geek out on something we don't have to think about.
That's right.
Happy to do it.
Okay.
Thanks, Paul.
Take care. Our next question is from Lori, who isn't sure if she should trust her engine. Go ahead, Lori.
Basically, we have a brand new, newly inspected engine. It had broken a push rod, and so we decided to send it into a major engine shop for an inspection and repair as necessary. And it flew well for a while. I mean, we're only like maybe 50 hours after that engine. But when the weather got cooler, I was doing my run-up, and the engine started to run roughly when I pulled the carb heat. And that was strange. So what we finally deduced was that in this narrow range of RPMs, like 1400 to 1600, it runs roughly, unless we have it at peak, we've leaned it to peak RPM. Now our airfield's at 7200 feet, so we always lean. I don't think I've ever run it full ridge. And so if you leave it there at peak RPM, it runs smoothly throughout its whole ground run range, you know, below 1,000 to, you know, 21, 2200, wherever we pull it back. But as we enrich it, like we do for maximum power for takeoff, it begins to run roughly in this RPM range. And so it doesn't matter if you've gotten there by changing to one mag, pulling the carb heat, pulling the throttle. And we think that, well, this did come on when the temperature dropped from like 70s or 80s down to 50s. And it doesn't seem to happen after we've landed after a flight. So there's some temperature dependency here. But it's not like it's just really when the engine's really cold. You know, we had it on the ground playing with it for half an hour and, you know, it was still showing this problem. So my question is, what else should we look at? Can I trust this? Is this just the way things are going to be? It had a rebuilt carburetor, rebuilt mags when they did the inspection.
That was going to be my question, if they did something with the carburetor. That's about the RPM. It's a little higher, but it's not too far from
happening at a field elevation of 7,200 RPM, I mean, 7,200 feet. I can't help but think maybe this is perfectly normal.
But it didn't do it before.
No, it didn't do it before. This is new after we got the engine back and the temperatures got cooler.
So, but, Paul, you...
But, you know, if you're not... I mean, you should always be lean to maximum RPM or leaner for ground operations, including the run-up. I mean, when you pull the carb heat, it drastically enriches the mixture. So if you're already rich when you do it, it can enrich in the mixture to the point that combustion may not occur in one or more cylinders. What kind of airplane is this?
It's a 172RG. It has a Lycoming engine.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Paul was on to something about the rebuilt carb in the accelerator. You were going to talk about the two regimes that it operates in.
There's a transition from it. Now, I'm not a 172 RG engine guy, and I don't see Lycoming's much anymore, but I'm pretty sure that it transitions through different jets in the carburetor. And so let me ask you a question. When you start the engine and you're taxiing, do you lean during ground operations or do you just lean prior to takeoff?
No, after it's started and it's running smoothly, which is, you know, very, very shortly, we pull it back and lean it. Not precisely, but, you know, it looks about right, you know.
Yeah, the TLAR system.
And it'll usually, right. And it'll usually stumble if I forget to enrich it a little before I start to taxi.
Yeah. It seems to me, I'm agreeing with Mike, I think this may be somewhat normal. You didn't experience it before. You had a different carburetor. Things were set up a little bit different, maybe different jets in the carburetor, different float setup. I mean, it's just different. And the fact that it has a little vibration as you pass through that RPM, I don't think that would be a particular concern. I won't tell you what my engine does when I pass through that RPM, but it's pretty exciting. But I don't have a carburetor, so I can't blame it on the carburetor. Yeah, I think, and Lycoming actually even came out, not specifically for this engine, but for ground runs, for doing your mag checks, they recommend leaning to max RPM before you do a mag check on the restart 172s and 182s and 206s.
And the run-up is typically at 2,000 RPM, 1,800
or 2,000? 1,800, 2,000, yeah. And you'll go, we used to, and you still can if you get in one of those restart airplanes and do a mag check at full rich. It'll be 200 to 250 RPM drop, and that was normal. And if you lean it, it'll be 80 RPM drop. It's a dramatic difference.
Yeah, I always lean to max RPM for my run-up. Yeah, but
leaning to max RPM for taxi round is good,
you
too.
You did too, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure that they were doing that too. It's in the POH, so...
And you know, look, if you're taking off from a low-altitude airport, then we use an excessively rich mixture to provide additional detonation margin. But if you're taking off from a 7,200-foot airport,
there is
you
no
know,
there.
You're at low cruise power when you're at full throttle. So maximum RPM is exactly where you want to be.
Okay. How about cooling? Do we need to worry about the engine getting too hot if we're at peak RPM, or just
do you have an engine monitor?
You always have to worry about it, but my guess is it's not going to be a problem
because you're not making as much power as you would at sea level.
Because you're making,
and you can monitor
70% power or less.
Yeah, you lean to the max power takeoff, and as you're taking off in the initial climb out, if the CHTs are coming up a little bit, you can increase the mixture, richen it as needed to keep the CHTs down.
It would be worth doing an RPM rise test and seeing if the idle mixture is correctly adjusted.
That's a good idea.
But that's pretty much the only adjustment you have on that carburetor is the idle mixture adjustment.
So it might be too rich, is what you're saying? Or
well, at low idle with a warm engine, you slowly retard the mixture and watch the tachometer, and you should get a small RPM rise before the engine starts to stumble and threaten to quit. And that RPM rise should be somewhere in the 50 RPM vicinity. And if you get a much bigger rise, if you get more than 100 RPM rise, then that says that the idle mixture is too rich. And if you don't get a rise, or you get way less than 50 RPM, or if it just dies, then the idle mixture is too lean. And it's just a little needle valve adjustment on the carburetor. And that's pretty much the only adjustment that there is on the carburetor. And that's something that the carburetor guys, when they overhaul the carburetor, can't really adjust. It has to be adjusted on the airplane. So it is possible that the new carburetor was installed, but there was never an RPM rise test to adjust that. So that would be worth doing. And just the next time you come in from a flight and you have a nice warm engine, throttle it back to low idle, which is typically like 800 RPM or something, and and then very slowly retard the mixture and see how much RPM rise you get before the engine starts to stumble.
It actually, it should, when you pull the throttle all the way back, it should idle about 600 to 650. What Mike is saying is true. 800 is a good place to do this test, but I'll do presentations at some of these events with the high performance airplanes, and I'll find out people think that their idle speed is 1,000 RPM because that's what they use to taxi.
And their brakes are worn.
Yeah, I was like, no.
But that is another adjustment on the carburetor. I lied. It's not that's the only fuel related adjustment, but the idle RPM stop is also an adjustable stop screw. So
you want both of those set correctly. You want to be able to pull it back to the 600 RPM idle speed so that when you're on final and you need the engine to come all the way back so you can actually get slow enough to land, it will do that. And the mixture that Mike is talking about, it's a pain to do because you typically have to take cowling on and off every time you make the adjustment. And you don't want to do it on a cold engine. It needs to be on a warm engine. But yeah, that should definitely be checked. But in terms of what we were saying before, the takeoff and climb, I think it's probably great.
Well, Lori, I sympathize with you because I don't like change. And if it's different when you get it back from the shop and something's different, that bugs me to no end. So
sure.
I completely understand, but hopefully we put your fears at rest here.
Yeah, get the idle speed and idle mixture checked.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you.
Okay, yeah. Thanks so much for calling in.
Our next question is from John, who might be experiencing morning sickness. Hopefully not. Let's find out. Hey, John.
Hi. Hey, thanks for doing this podcast. I've really learned a lot, you know.
We do too.
So not to beat the leaning and lead topic totally into the ground, but my partners and I have an RV7A with about 345 hours on the airframe and engine, which is an 0360 carbureted. And we've got an EMS, Dynon EMS. I've been borescoping the cylinders at each condition inspection, and we've been noticing an increase of lead buildup, including on the exhaust valve stems, at least one of them. I try to peek in there. I don't get very good photos. So anyway, we do lean aggressively for taxi. And since hearing your podcast about being able to run carbureted Lycomings, lean a peak, we've been doing that in cruise, and that's been maybe the last 20, 30 hours. So I'm thinking that where this lead came from is a combination of not running lean for a few hundred hours. And then also our CHTs have never been up to the level that you recommend for avoiding sticking valves. You know, in the winter, they're like around 300. And in the summer, even we barely get up to 360 on one or two of the cylinders. So I got concerned because the engine was running rough for a couple minutes after start. And a friend of ours who has an RV9A with an 0320 was using something called Decalin, which I think is the same as STP, at his mechanic's recommendation. And he said that, well, this can prevent lead buildup and even clear out lead. So I was wondering what your take on that is. And I've also been told that just running lean a peak can reduce lead. So I'm wondering about all that stuff.
To the best of my knowledge, nothing can clean off lead other than emery cloth or
a chisel,
Scotch-Brite or something. I don't think there's any way you can remove lead once it's built up, but I have to say, looking at those photographs, that's one of the least leady looking Lycomings I've ever seen.
Clean. The seats
don't know,
are making good contact.
I don't know why, but Lycoming engines seem always to have more lead buildup than Continental engines. When we look at them under the borescope, I don't know why. And though that engine seems for a Lycoming seems to have very few deposits.
You should see pictures of my engines. They don't look like that. It looks like some gold plated, you know, encrusted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These look pretty good to me.
I did see the white spots on the valve stems that you were mentioning, but it doesn't look really that bad.
Yeah, that's the one right there.
Yeah, yeah, we saw it on the edge a little bit, but the underside of the valve looks good.
Yeah, you look at that picture that's up there now. The underside of the valve, you can see the black contact area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it looks like it's making really good contact with the seat. As far as we can see on the photograph. So keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, it looks good to me.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
The thing is, all those deposits in there, as long as the exhaust valve is making good contact with the valve seat, which yours appear to, that's that dark ring. You'll see it on the seat and on the valve. If that contact area is good and solid and continuous, the other gunk that's in there, it's not really gunk, the crusty stuff that builds up on top of the piston sometimes and maybe in the cylinder head, they really don't hurt anything. It's just kind of there.
It's reducing your combustion area, though.
So yeah, yeah, I mean,
the only part of this whole thing that bothers me at all is the fact that you say your CHTs are quite low.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there's anything you can do about that. I take it that the RV doesn't have cowl flaps, right?
No, we don't have cowl flaps. And one thing that was recommended to me by another pilot who did have a case of stuck valves is to block the air outlet at the bottom of the cowl, block it partially.
Exactly what I was about to suggest.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, my only hesitation about that is that it's really easy to get over 400 CHT and climb, particularly on number 3. And so I kind of have to baby it on climb out, even in the winter to keep the CHTs reasonable.
Yeah, 420 is acceptable on a Lycoming and in climb. I wouldn't want to go above that. And you might want to block it off with like duct tape or something.
Just as an experiment
to see get the blockage to where you like it, because you're basically adjusting the cooling airflow and the cooling drag.
It's too bad.
And then
if you can
find a sweet spot, then you can get rid of the duct tape and put a piece of aluminum there.
So something to consider, we talked about blocking the outlet. You might also, as opposed to that, partially block the inlet, which is what most people do. Matter of fact, on the Cessna, like the Skylane and 172s, the winterization kit is actually a piece of aluminum that you screw onto the cowling air inlet that partially blocks the air, how much air comes in. And as an experimental, you can experiment with maybe blocking off part of the right air inlet or part of the left air inlet, as opposed to both of them. And you can change the airflow through the engine. You may find that you can do something that actually helps that number 3, which is the right rear. Typical Lycoming engine, it's going to run the hottest. On my twin Comanche, they did. But that was partly because that's where the oil cooler was. But at any rate, you can do a lot of things. Careful and slow application, small bit at a time, to see what the results are.
And you may also find that blocking the inlets may make it more efficient in cooling, because there is a magic ratio between the inlet area and the outlet area. There was a great article written in, I'm not sure what publication, but I have a scan of it, it was written by an engineer who did all kinds of research about the, the frontal area of the inlet and then the exhaust area, and you want a certain ratio. And if you look at high-performance aircraft like a Lancair 360, that the cowlings are, modified. They have these very small, round inlets. And you'd think, wow, there's not enough air going in that engine to provide cooling, but it's actually tuned to give you just the right amount of cooling. So smaller isn't necessarily less cooling. Smaller could increase the airflow.
So just racing do people everything, think like this.
Do everything in small increments is what I would recommend. I played around with my Skybolt, which has these big open inlets, and I think I was able to partially block some of the air going into one cylinder one, and it forced more air up over the cylinder and into the back of the engine where I needed it. So it's kind of fun to do on an experimental. I don't do that on my
John is certified. Is your oil cooler, does it get its air from behind cylinder three like Paul's twin Comanche did?
Yeah.
Oh.
So I wonder whether partially blocking the airflow into the oil cooler. I don't know what your oil temperatures are like, but if you seem to have plenty of oil cooling, you might possibly want a
winterization kit.
Yeah.
I put a shutter over the outlet to the oil cooler in the summer.
In the summer?
Winter.
In the winter.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah.
And when you close that shutter to reduce the airflow through the oil cooler, does that help the cooling of cylinder three? Have you ever noticed?
Well, you know, I haven't checked that.
It probably does.
That would be interesting to look at.
Yep.
There's all kinds of data you can collect. More you excuses can just to fly.
The other thing we did is the baffling kit had these vertical plates in front of each front cylinder.
Mm-hmm. Right. Uh-huh.
And because we were also getting number one and two a little too warm, we removed that one. And I've read since that can have the opposite effect. That actually,
that's usually not a good idea.
Yeah. Okay.
Because we're not trying to cool those cylinders with ram air. We're trying to just get high pressure on top of the engine and have the airflow vertical from top to bottom. So that the reason for those plates is to not allow the front cylinders to be cooled by the air blast because that's basically robbing cooling air from the rear cylinders.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot for appreciate all of that input. I got a lot to work on. Okay, and thanks for the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, John.
Okay, take care.
Our next question is from Steve, who has found something about engine monitors he doesn't like, as if that's even possible.
Oh,
go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I guess my complaint or concerns or questions are about digital revolutions that are happening in our cockpits. We operate a PA32-300 with an IO540 K1A5, and we have a CGR30P engine monitor. And the Lycoming operator's manual lists numbers for the oil pressure as max 95, min 55, idling 25, startup and warm up at 115 PSI. The POH has different numbers for some reason. It has 60 to 90 for a green range, green arc. A yellow of 25 to 60, that would be the lower range. The red line minimum of 25 and a red line maximum of 90. Here's the problem those cause is that our engine monitor came configured with master warning and master caution capability, red and yellow lights respectively. And our airplane, when it's cold, exceeds the 90 PSI POH number by about 5 to 7 PSI. So what happens is on takeoff, it jumps to 95 or 97 PSI. And our master warning light, which is right above our G5, you know, our primary flight display, starts flashing. Now, most private pilots have no idea what a master warning or caution is for. But a blinking, flashing red light right in your face really should mean something, right? Mm-hmm. I think even the average knucklehead like myself would say, okay, reject the takeoff and figure out what's going on. But now with this new digital capability, there it is, it's just become a nuisance light. And we've just grown to ignore it. Now, if something else was going on and we just ignore it, that's a problem. So since my original question that I submitted to Ian was, why is the POH different from the Lycoming manual? And should we be able to change the settings in our engine monitor? Well, since submitting this, I have discovered that yes, you can change the engine monitor ranges for pressure, but it has to be done by the manufacturer of the engine monitor, and you have to submit a form which is signed by an A&P that says, yes, you can use these numbers, and there's a nominal fee.
It's called a CYA form because, because they don't want the liability at the engine monitor place. They want to put it on your mechanic. So that makes total sense.
This is a pet peeve of mine that some engine monitor manufacturers have made the alert limits non-user programmable, which is and they hardwire them to the manufacturer's red lines. The fact that you've got a yellow alert too is a plus. That's helpful, but it's still you don't have control over where it goes off. So if you decide that you have a personal CHT maximum of 420 degrees, you can't just go in there and say, well, I'm going to set the CHT alarm at 420. With some manufacturers, you can do that, like JPI, and some manufacturers have chosen not to do that. Now, there's some valid reason for that for engine monitors that are primary instrument replacements, where you're ripping a whole bunch of factory gauges out and putting the engine monitor in. But the CGR30P is typically not a primary replacement device. It's a supplemental device. I saw a whole bunch of steam gauges in your airplane that looked like they were
still
put there by the factory when Piper built the airplane. So in a situation like that, I just think there's no justification for the manufacturer not making those user programmable. Having said that, even if they have to be set by the engine monitor manufacturer, they should be willing to set it to what you tell them to set it. And apparently they are. You said that you can submit a form, send the instrument in, and they'll flash the firmware. It's a shame you can't do that in the field. It's a shame you have to send the engine monitor back to do that. But at least they're willing to do that.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Actually, they send you a thumb drive and it reprograms it in your hangar.
Oh, but they charge you for that.
Oh, so you don't have to.
Yeah. But they charge you for the thumb drive.
Oh, then that's not so bad.
Do you get to keep the thumb drive? I mean,
they probably.
It only works. It only works once.
They probably don't charge you that much. Maybe you can reverse engineer it. And
it's a very expensive thumb drive. That's all I'll say.
But you know, just from my meager knowledge of Lycoming engines, the POH sounds like it's just completely wrong. I have no idea where Piper got those numbers.
Why would the POH be more conservative, Mike, than the?
I mean, it's just wrong. It's just wrong to say that 90 psi is redline in Lycoming.
Yeah.
That I mean, normally Lycoming green arc goes up to 95.
Yeah.
And well, the red line should
idle
be
this engine in the winter when you first started it below 90 psi.
And I mean, if you just couldn't solve this problem, then the solution would probably be to adjust the oil pressure down just enough so it doesn't quite trigger the red light. But that's the tail wagging the dog for an engine monitor manufacturer to be telling you how you should adjust your oil pressure. Just seems so wrong. So on so many levels.
And that led to the second part of my question is that, why are the POH numbers different than the Lycoming numbers? Yeah. Can anyone explain who is making the choices regarding the presentation and intended use of this digital information? And is there any standard to which the manufacturers of these devices are being held?
Well, hang on. So your digital information is aftermarket. So that has nothing to do with the original
though.
What Piper did in their certification. It's really not that uncommon for the airframe manufacturer to put different numbers on engine parameters than the engine manufacturer does. Columbia did that. If you look at their maximum fuel flows for a Columbia 400, in the limitations section of the manual, it'll say the maximum fuel flow, I'm rounding these off, or like 36 to 38 gallons an hour for takeoff. But then you flip the page and it talks about the markings for the gauges and it'll say red line is at 40 gallons an hour. So even within the POH, it has two different numbers as maximum. And Continental says for that engine, 36 to 38 is your maximum fuel flow. What Columbia kind of sneakily, they snuck in that they need a little bit more fuel flow for the climb to keep the CHTs down. So they added another couple of gallons an hour and put Redline at 40. Works just fine. So I don't know why Piper did this, but it seems to me if, and I don't know, is this an instrument installed as primary?
Well, I would think yes.
I mean,
There's no manifold pressure gauge left. Cylinder head, none of that. Okay, flames. None of that exists anymore except for the CGR 30P.
Okay.
What were all those little square gauges that I saw in
those
the
are
video?
Fuel gauges.
That is the fuel gauges.
Yeah, fuel quantity. Yes.
Yeah, they have
Fuel quantity.
Okay. Okay.
So
we didn't get that option, but you could install 4 fuel sensors and then have it monitoring.
It's primary. I actually think that's probably good. They probably are required because it's primary to have factory control over where those alerts are, and they do have the facility for you to update them in your hangar with the thumb drive they provide, and if they say send us a form signed by an A&P, we'll send you a thumb drive. That sounds pretty reasonable to me.
Thank you so much for everything you guys do. And this is like my brush with greatness moment. You know, you run into General Yeager in an elevator. I got to talk with Mike Bush. This is fantastic. And Colleen and Paul, this is wonderful. Yeah. Thank you.
We're all here.
Okay, well, great. Thanks for calling in.
Have a great day.
Thanks.
Bye.
Well, that's a wrap on another podcast. Did we get anything right? And what did we get wrong? We would love to hear from you. Just keep sending us those tricky questions and try to stump us. You can send your questions and comments to podcasts@aopa.org.
We'll see ya.
Bye-bye, everybody.